Welcome to the Hello First Name Podcast. The Hello First Name Podcast revolves around the term personalization and is brought to you by marketing author Rasmus Holin, founder of Omnichannel Institute and chief experience officer at the marketing automation software company Agilic. The podcast is based on the book Hello First Name. Each episode is based in turn on a chapter from the book, followed by a discussion of the very same chapter with an expert marketing practitioner in the following episode. As always, you can buy the book on Amazon or other bookstores. You can also choose to listen to it all for free on your favorite podcast service. You're also very welcome to download the abstract of the book for free, and all models, of course, are able to download. All downloads are sponsored by Agilic. I'll make sure to put a link to everything in the show notes. But you can always connect on LinkedIn, and I'll be happy to reply and help out. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Hello First Name podcast. Today, we're going to discuss chapter 16 from the book, Data and Personalization, the chapter is called. It's one of the chapters from the prerequisites of personalization, which is part three of the book. So I'm very pleased to welcome a Chief Consulting Officer at Nexum, Michael Biedenharder. Michael, welcome.
Rasmus, thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Michael, your Chief Consulting Officer at the DACH-based digital agency Nexus AG, and you also have your own consulting company on the side, and you're a longtime host of the Loyalty Podcast. So, Arun, maybe in your own words, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your career?
Yes, of course. Hello, everybody. I live in beautiful Switzerland in the top northwestern part, close to the German and French borders. I did a master's degree once in business administration with a focus in marketing. And after my studies, I started working in retail business and stayed there for quite a few years, like for almost 15 years, and held different, let's say, management positions in retail business. But for most of the time, I was responsible for a department which was called Digital CRM and Data Analytics at Coop in Switzerland. Yeah. Coop is the largest retailer company in Switzerland. So
yeah, we have Coop in the Nordics as well. Yeah,
yeah,
it's pretty big. And normally, everybody is a member of that club.
Yeah, I will talk about this later. it's really a huge membership program. But yeah, the core business is groceries, but they also have a different other retail businesses like department stores, DIY, and so on. And I spent almost 15 years in retail, as I said before, and it was quite an interesting time actually, because when I started was in the early 2000s. So during this time, like topics like digital commerce, digital marketing, CRM, loyalty, data, they were just side notes in marketing. So marketing was, by this time, it was like advertising, big TV commercials,
leaflets, print advertising. And
it's really was a different time. And also at university, by this time, we didn't learn anything about digital or CRM. It was just about, although I started marketing or did a deep dive in marketing, there was nothing about digital and CRM. So I started there in the early 2000s and really had the opportunity to build up a lot of things in these areas, like, of course, not alone, together with the team, and also had to learn or had the chance to learn a lot on the jobs. I will talk about it later. We did a really cool things in the areas of digitization and also, of course, in personalization. But although my job was very interesting and I really liked it, but I then decided to do something different. After this long time in retail business, I wanted to just change something in my life or in my business life. And then I founded Miserhead, that's the consulting company you mentioned before. I founded it in end of 2018. Miserhead is a boutique consultancy company which is focused on, I would say, digitization and CRM, like as the core topics. And beside this, I still run it. Beside this, I'm also in the advisory board of a regional brewery in Basel, which is, to me, as a beer lover.
That's a fantastic gig. You know, having your dividends paid out in beer. I mean, who would not like that?
Yeah, it's a dream for a man who likes beer, and also like we talked about it last time in Köln, I think. Yeah. The general assembly of the company is in 3 weeks. It's a big event in Basel. There are about 3,000 or 4,000 people coming to the general assembly and getting their dividends, so the liquid dividends, and they drink about 6,000 to 8,000 liter beers.
My God.
So it's a really fun evening every year.
And then there's the loyalty podcast. And how did that start? And you've been running quite a lot of episodes on that, right?
Yes, the loyalty podcast. Actually, it started in 2019, I think. No, 2020.
COVID.
It was COVID. We were preparing a study on loyalty programs in Switzerland, and the study consisted of two parts. One part was a classical customer survey, a quantitative survey about different loyalty programs in Switzerland. And the other part was interviews with loyalty experts, so like program managers or from service companies, from consultancy companies, experts, and so on. And as we had planned these interviews, we realized, we're going to talk to many loyalty experts.
Yeah.
And then we came up with the idea, why not record this and publish this as a podcast? And that's how the Loyalty Talk podcast started.
Yeah, fantastic. How many episodes do you have in it?
Oh, I think 33 or 34, something like that. At the beginning, it was more regularly. Now it's just from time to time when I find some time to do this.
And it's in German, right?
It's in German, actually.
All right.
Not in Swiss German, it's in German.
At least, yeah.
Most guests are from Switzerland, but so my colleagues or their colleagues in Germany, they also understand it because Swiss German is hard to understand for Germans.
What was the biggest surprise that you've learned through these interviews?
The biggest surprise at the beginning, to be honest, because I didn't expect so many people to agree the recording. I thought maybe a third of the interviews, but was like 75% or even more, or even 80% of the people agreed. And when you think it was like 4 years ago, so podcasting was not that common like it is now. So a lot of the people were, a lot of the people were like in the podcast for the first time. So it was a fairly new experience for them as well. And although most of them agreed, and since then we're running it, and I think that was the greatest surprise.
And how do you see, because we're talking about personalization today, and the loyalty podcast is obviously about loyalty, but I know at Nexum you're working with all kinds of other ways of getting more customer centricity into customer experiences. But how do you see the personalization and the loyalty fit together?
Well, quite close, I would say, and you can have a look at it from two sides. I would say it's on one side, or on one hand, it's like personalization is a driver for loyalty.
Yeah,
because when you have a kind of a personalized experience, this can massively improve the customer experience. And when you improve the customer experience, normally, not obviously, but normally, you drive customer loyalty. Mm. When there is a positive customer experience,
yeah.
Can also be a negative, then maybe it can be the other way around, but
nothing is bad now. Personalization gone wrong.
yes, definitely. And also my own experience, I listen to music a lot, and I own a lot of CDs and a lot of vinyl as well, but also I listen to Spotify. And what they do in terms of personalization is so great. I mean, they really know me because I use it that much.
Yeah.
They know my musical preferences. They know my musical behavior, and they manage to lock me into this platform.
Yeah.
So I would never change.
Yeah.
And so they, with personalization, they created a super customer experience and generated loyalty. So I would never spend money for Amazon, for example, or Apple Music, because I just locked in into Spotify.
Probably, I don't know what it is with you, but my kids are also using Spotify, and my wife. So family subscription. So we're actually tying each other in. And it's I would never throw away my custom playlists, and especially the the auto-generated radios that you can have. Because it knows me and it knows all my favorites and the songs I like. When I take a tune that I like, say, do me a radio on this, that just generates a lot of really good listening experiences.
Yeah, definitely. Same with us. So my wife also uses it as well. So, and we also have shared playlists together. And yeah, it's really, really, they do a really good job. So that's the one side I wanted to describe, that really personalization drives loyalty.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, especially when you think about loyalty programs, then loyalty or loyalty programs in specific are, I would say, an enabler for personalization.
Yeah.
Because when you're not an online pure play, when you're an online pure play, it's a little bit different because you have the customer accounts normally and you have data and so on. But if you think like you're a brick and mortar retailer or a brick and mortar business, then you normally don't have any customer data. So you need to get the customer data, you need to identify the customer and so on. So what you do normally, or what a lot of retailers, for example, do, they run a loyalty program and to identify the customers, to identify the transactions, to get some data, to have like the foundation for personalization.
Yeah.
So it really goes close together, these two topics.
Which role does it play at Nexum? How are you working with personalization with your clients? Demand for? Are they talking about it? Are they already doing it a lot? The clients, and
I would say it's all these topics, like in personalization, loyalty, CRM, this all goes together a little bit. It's a general development, I would say, that these topics are becomingly increasingly relevant with our customers. And we are, I would say, noticing that more and more companies, they realize that they need to change their focus, because in the last years, a couple of years, a lot of companies were focusing on customer acquisition. And now you see slowly, but you see a change, that a lot of companies, they switch their budgets, they switch their focus, they switch also their skills more to retention instead of acquisition. Of course, you always need acquisition, but it's a kind of mixture in the marketing budgets and then also in your organization. And one of the main reasons I experienced when you talk with the clients is that on one hand, the rising costs of customer acquisition. And on the other hand, it's a greater focus, I would say, on profitability in companies.
Yeah.
It's not that much about growth anymore.
Yeah.
It's more about like getting more profitable.
Yeah.
And of course, it's also a driver is also the actual economic situation, and money is getting more expensive. So there are a few macroeconomic factors as well.
Yeah.
It's not only this, it's also because other people are in management now and they realize that marketing is changing or has changed in the past. So it's also like maybe a little bit more long-term thinking, not just focusing on the short term. So there are a few factors, but in a nutshell, we really, as I said before, we really realize that these topics, they're getting more relevant. And of course, for us as a digital agency or digital consultancy, we also see a growth in for example, consultancy service, in CRM, loyalty, personalization, and also a higher demand for technical solutions like personalization engines, marketing automation engines, CRM softwares, and so on.
Yeah, we're happy with that here at Agilic.
I can imagine.
Yeah. All right. I realize that you're maybe not super familiar with where personalization is in the Nordics. But anyway, I'd still like to ask you how far you are in DACH region, Germany, Switzerland, Austria.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is your perception of the general maturity layer? Are companies generally very advanced with this, or are they not? And also another topic, which is about consumer skepticism. I think from an outsider, a non-DACH resident, I think there's this perception of the DACH people, the German people maybe in particular, to have a larger skepticism about data collection and personalization and regarding privacy and treasuring that more than maybe Nordic consumers and UK consumers. Where do you see sort of the maturity level for the companies and the consumers in DACH?
Well, compared to Nordics, it's hard to say because I don't know the Nordics that well, but I know more like the, I would say, Anglo-American markets and also a little bit more the Asian countries. Yeah. And compared to these countries, and with Anglo-American countries, I don't mean just USA. I mean, for if you look at Australia, New Zealand, for example, as well, of course, UK and so on. And also South Africa. I think in general, the DACH area, or especially Germany and Switzerland, where I'm more into, or we are more into, is lagging somewhat behind these countries. And I think one of the reasons is just what you mentioned before, that in Germany, people are maybe a little bit more skeptical. Mm-hmm. About like data privacy. It could be also because of GDPR.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk negatively about GDPR, don't get me wrong, but it was the topic was in the media and all the people were discussing it and so on. And you also you read the bad stories about the big internet companies and so on.
Yeah.
So, this is a point where people, I think, in the end get more skeptical about giving the data and the usage of data. And also maybe what also is or could be a reason, I don't know it exactly, is GDPR in general, because it's not on the customer side when you think on the corporate side, or because a lot of companies, they maybe were uncertain, what can we do, what can't we do, which data we can collect, and so on. And there were also like...
Better do nothing, because then we're not doing any mistakes.
it's really like this. So really, they didn't do anything, or they've maybe first had to check, or they first had to ensure that they are compliant with GDPR regulations. So this took quite a lot of time. And maybe a lot of companies lost some time there, and that's why companies are lagging behind.
Yeah,
and in Switzerland, maybe Switzerland is maybe a little different as well. We don't have GDPR in Switzerland. Mm. We now have a new Datenschutzverordnung or Datenschutzgesetz, so a similar thing. It's based on the GDPR, but it was introduced last year, so it's quite fresh.
Yeah,
but in Switzerland, it's often also a question of size of the companies, I would say, because when you want to do personalization, you can read your book, what you need in personalization. Yeah. So you need a lot of things. It's not that easy. Yeah. It's not done in 5 minutes. And when you imagine you're in a medium-sized company, you are 3 to 4 people in marketing, you don't have that huge marketing budget. Yeah. And in Switzerland, there are a lot of companies equipped like this.
Yeah.
Then personalization is maybe not the hot topic on your agenda, or you don't even have the budgets or the internal resources to do it.
I think that's very comparable to the Nordics, actually, because, I mean, maybe in Germany, the customer databases are really huge, but in the Nordics, they are not. So if you have a customer database of 1.5 million, then you are in top 5% of how big the customer databases are, at least that'd be in Denmark, Norway. For Sweden, it'll be a bit bigger since the population is like 9-10 million people. So so that's definitely something that we have in common. I think the smaller your customer database is, which is also what we're going to discuss here, the more efficient you need to be. Because if you are, I mean, if it has to be worth the effort to do an extra variant of your content and your messages, you will be wanting a bigger audience within that segment, or it will not be worth the effort, really, unless you're super efficient in the way.
Definitely.
But what role do you see data play in personalization? Because that's basically what we are discussing today at a more general level. Seeing data as a prerequisite, how does that work in personalization? Which role does data play? Does it play other roles? How do you see that based on your experience and the loyalty podcast?
Well, yes, in general, without data, there is no personalization, or it's hard to make personalization without data. So if I, as a company, if I know nothing about my customers, how can I respond to their needs, to their preference? Impossible. So it's like, as you said, a prerequisite. So you just have to have it. But what my experience is, and it hasn't changed in the last years, actually, very, very fast, is that also like the topics, data and data management, they are, I would say, among the most underestimated topics in the companies.
Yeah.
When you tackle personalization, most companies, they don't think about data management, for example.
Yeah.
They just think about implementing a marketing automation suite, for example. Yeah. But then they wonder why it didn't work.
Yeah.
But of course, and then they call you as an agency and can you have a look? And then you go into and say, sorry to say, but shit data, shit in, shit out. So if you don't have any data, or if your data is like shitty and
you didn't put in the fuel for the engine. Sorry.
Yeah. Good comparison. Yeah, it's really this. And a lot of people, they don't have it on the agenda, and that's why we at Nexum, we often experience more, let's say, or experience that the projects are more like data management projects than marketing automation projects, for example, or personalization projects, because you need 50% or even more time, or a percent of your effort you need for data things, or things around data, like data cleaning, data aggregating, whatever. So it's a lot about data. So
how much data do you need as a business for personalization to be profitable? No, it's a tricky question.
it's a good question, but also very tricky. And I would say there is no golden rule for this. I mean, that's a question. A lot of companies often ask, how much? And so I'm like, I mean, there is no golden rule. It depends on so many, many dimensions. But one is for sure. I mean, in the end, you said it before as well. It's about scale. It's about how many customers you have in your database. Mm. I mean, if you have 10,000 customers, it's different than when you have 10 million customers in a database. It's just the lever is completely different with 10 million customers.
Yeah.
So scale, or amount of customers or members or whatever it is, or newsletter subscribers, whatever. So, but this is really one of the important factors. It's on one hand, it leverages your revenue or your margin, and on the other hand, it's also you can distribute your costs over more people, more members. If you have 10 million to 10,000, and the costs, especially like the investment costs, they're similar if you have 10 million or if you have 10,000, because you need tools, you need expertise, and so you need maybe external resources as well. And this costs you almost the same money if you have 10,000 or 1 million or 10 million or 100 million customers in your database or addressable database. And that's why what I said before, in Switzerland, maybe a few companies or a lot of companies, they don't reach this volume. And for them, it's also maybe too costly to invest in personalization.
Yeah. But I guess if you have a high basket size, average basket size, if people are buying. So for instance, I used to work for FL Schmidt, which is a huge company in Denmark, and they're making cement factories. So their basket size is quite crazy. I mean, okay, at the shopping basket, one cement factory, that's going to cost you. So I think they could probably do with the list of leads that is less than 100,000.
It's maybe the other factor then, or one of the other central dimensions, that is could be the value of the transaction or the customer lifetime value in general.
Yeah.
If this is really high, then it compensates for amount of customers. So if you think, for example, I don't know, B2B business, as you said before, or capital goods sectors, their personalization can also be profitable. when you have a smaller scale.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work, for example, in retail business or especially in grocery retail business, because the uplifts you generate there are so small. So you need mass to reach a significant uplift to cover your costs that you need to invest in personalization.
Yeah. That's kind of what we're seeing here also from an Agilic point of view, that we'd really like to bring sort of the Nordic efficiency that we need to have in place, or else the clients here wouldn't make it profitable. Really bring that to the large scale operations of especially central DACH region. So, but talking about so I think we established now that the size of your database, I mean, not in data points, but in how many people you can reach,
people
is an important thing, and also the basket size or the CLV, how much money you make per client is important. But how about having, you know, the right data versus just having a lot of data? How do you see the importance there?
Yeah, I think I can give a clear statement, because in general, I would always say that having the right data is more important than having tons of data.
Yeah.
Because when you don't have the right data, it's hard to implement any use cases. Especially when you're at the beginning, it's good to start with a few good use cases, maybe also easy to implement use cases to get some first success, also to prove to the management that it does something with your turnover, for example, or with your margin. So you focus maybe on a few core moments of truth in your journey. So you focus on a few use cases, and then you have to have the right data for these use cases. Yeah.
So finding out the most important moments of truth and see, we get data for that, because that's probably where we'd start.
And really proceed quite fast. Try to really prove that it works, and maybe do the more complex stuff later on.
Yeah.
And this is also is a thing, you know, when you get more mature, and you want to do more sophisticated things with personalization, then I would say it gets more important that you get more data, or you have more data, because then when you're not doing the easy things, like, I don't know, I left a basket, or I registered for an email, and you do a welcome journey, or you send a birthday mailing. So like this out of the box things, I call it out of the box, because these are really normally the easy things, not always, but often they are the easier things. But as soon as you want to go beyond this, and you want to implement like more complex use cases, then often more data is required. And then often like things that I mentioned before, like data integration, generating a 360 degree customer profile, things like this. Or then we are talking about, for example, a CDP, a customer data platform. So then you're more mature and you're on a higher level, and you need maybe more tools, I would say, but you also need more data. And also, it's not just having data then, it's also like mastering the data. So you maybe then need more skills, you need analytical skills.
Cleaning data maybe. And
yes, of course. Yeah, you need...
Disposing of old data and...
Yes, you need the processes around this. And you also need, you know, let's make an example. We were talking about CLV before. If you, for example, want to do a segmentation based on CLV, it's not rocket science, but it's more tricky than do a segmentation based on, I don't know, let's say demographics, for example. So when you want to do it based on CLV, you need more data, because you have to have data history about each customer.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can't calculate a CLV. And you also need to calculate a CLV model for your business or for your own business. And you need to do the strategical and the conceptual work. Mm-hmm. What do we do now with the CLV?
Yeah.
Do we target different segments with different customer values differently, and so on? So it gets much more complex.
And also CLV is often looking at things in the rearview mirror, and really where you want to spend your marketing spend is who has the potential. So
yeah, more predictive. Yeah.
So I've seen companies also using third party data maybe. So getting data, third party data on what is the average income for people in these areas or in these
posts. Yeah, for example.
Then sort of comparing that. So we have someone who should be able to spend this kind of money with us, but they're only spending this, and that would give some kind of potential for these particular customers, where you'd then maybe make a bigger effort to get them back into the store, get them to purchase more from your company.
Yeah.
Talking about these different data types, zero party data, first party data, and third party data. Where would you start? So say that you are fresh off, you had a retailer, you launched a loyalty program, people were coming to your store, but you just launched. How would you prioritize, you know, getting zero party data where you ask people about different things, getting first party data from their transactions and maybe their wish lists and so on, a third party data where you can maybe get some details on the average income or whatever from the household? How would you prioritize that in a sort of loyalty scenario?
Well, I would always start with zero and first party data.
Yeah.
It depends. Maybe there is one exclusion. If you're in the acquisition mode, maybe you have to buy some external addresses. Yeah. This could be. Let's skip this and let's assume we are in the enrollment phase. So you start normally with zero party data because the customer, they need to register somewhere, and there you have to be careful not to create too many barriers.
Yeah.
So what you normally do is like, especially when you have a digital onboarding, which is nowadays more like the standard, not like the offline forms when you enroll for a loyalty program. What you often do is like that you really lower the barriers. So the clients, they maybe just have to enter name, email, and gender, for example. And what you then normally do is I call it progressive profiling.
Yeah.
So you really try to initially make it as easy as possible so that you have a high conversion rate.
Yeah, low threshold.
Because
low
every data point you ask the customer, or every data point more you ask, is a risk for a lower conversion or that the customer leaves the process. So really, really start with just a few data points, and then just step by step enrich your database with could be first party data, zero party data, sorry, that you maybe ask the customer, give me your birth date, and then we'll send you a birthday gift, for example.
Yeah.
And this is also, I always tell our clients, quite important. You have to take into account that it's giving and taking. So the customer gives you something, he or she gives you the data, and it has a value for the customer, and you have to in return give him or her something back. So maybe you give, in this case, in this example, it was like a birthday gift, for example, but it could be something else. It's just like some kind of value you have to give to the customer.
And so coming back to the skepticism from consumers, if you are very aware of sort of the data value exchange, then that should be a good thing to consider.
Definitely, definitely, yeah. So it's like in the beginning, I would say it's a lot about zero party data.
Yeah.
Like really low entry barrier, then enrich with this progressive profiling methodology. And then you can, normally you automatically generate first party data because when you have a loyalty program, for example, and you're a retailer, for example, the customers, they use your loyalty card, they make their transaction, they show their loyalty card or they show their app or something like that at the cashier. So you generate more data, or maybe they use your app, they use your website, they click your newsletter, whatever. So you generate more data, you generate first party data, which you can use later on as well.
Yeah.
And this is not, I wouldn't say this is progressive profiling, but this is like a similar mechanism. You build up more and more data. You aggregate more data.
You get to know your customer.
You gain more knowledge. Yeah, definitely.
So it's like building up a memory of each individual end customer. And okay, so what is our brand's history with them? How can we get them to know, get to know them as good as possible, so that we can become more personalized in the way that we are doing our outreach?
It is. And maybe because you ask, let me just add something, because you ask about third-party data.
Yeah.
Of course, you can use third-party data, and there are some good use cases as well. But there's one big difference to zero and first-party data. Third-party data, they don't belong to you.
Yeah.
Zero and first-party data, they belong to you as a company. So you can do with it whatever you like. And of course, there is some cost with it. You know, data management it also produces cost, but it's not the same. Like with third-party data, often it's you pay per use. So every time you use the third-party data, it costs money. Mm. So this is one factor you have to take into account. And it's also that it also could happen that suddenly third-party data is no longer available. Let's just have a look at what happened now to the third-party cookie thing.
True.
I mean, the whole digital advertising industry was built up on third-party cookies. Yeah. Now they disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, they they still are there. Google still uses them.
I know they just postponed it again, the death of third-party cookies. But
like the fourth time or something like that. But it just can happen that
only
suddenly,
going one way with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I always recommend have a focus and first think about your zero and first party data strategy. So on your own data strategy before you think about third party data.
I heard a definition of zero party data once, which, because I mean, initially I just, when I first heard the term, I was like, yeah, zero party data, yada, yada. That's first party data. Now we call it something else. That's very fine. But the best explanation and the best reasoning for having this sort of new category, zero party data, was the fact that you can see zero-party data as something that you borrow from the customer because they type it in and they give you this information. Mm-hmm. But it actually, but you only borrow it because you don't have like a live feed of it. You don't; it doesn't become updated automatically unless you put in processes for asking the clients on a regular basis. But so it's basically data that you borrow, and it because that also means that it can become obsolete or become too old, outdated.
That's right, yes.
How do you see this? Does that happen with the other data types as well? Does that become outdated as well? How quick does it become outdated in different ways?
I think in general, almost every data point is kind of obsolete. It's just a question of when, of the time frame.
Yeah.
Some like, don't know, demographic data, maybe they're expire or getting obsolete more slowly than
I guess other a birth things, date maybe, is okay because I tend to have, unless I die, be overruled by my death date.
Yeah, but compared to, for example, to preferences or behaviors, this could change very quickly. It doesn't need to be, but it can.
A positive pregnancy test changes a lot of things.
That's right. Or maybe one example is like when you think about your, a fashion retailer, and we're talking about first-party data now, like a client is searching for something in your online shop. Then this data point can get obsolete very fast. I mean, in this moment, it's very important, but maybe in 2 weeks, it's not important anymore for this specific use case. So if you think about, you know, like a reminder mail, for example, maybe in 2 weeks, it doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah.
But maybe if you have a look at this use case, or if you don't want to send like a reminder mail, for example, instead you say, I want to aggregate more data, I want to learn more about the customers, then it still can have some value.
Yeah.
But then it's another use case. It's not a trigger point. It's more like you need it to sharpen your customer profile.
Yeah.
So if you want to know, you know, which colors does this customer like, which kind of styles, which kind of brands, whatever, then maybe it's still a good and valid data point and it doesn't get obsolete that fast.
Yeah.
But for this trigger mechanism, it's obsolete in days or maybe even in hours. So it's you always also have to think about what is the use case behind the data point.
Yeah, that makes sense. So if I can paraphrase what you just said. So having the profile data with interest and stuff, that can change quite fast. You need to probably re-ask the same question I think you're even obliged to, by law, to update your customers' interests and the data you have on them. Behavioral data, as in first-party data and transaction, that will be browsing data and whatever. All the behavioral data will be good for identifying the moments of truth, but them being moments also means that they are passing by rather quickly, leaving the data point maybe not useless or obsolete, but giving it another purpose, namely that of building the 360 degree view of the customer and what are they sort of looking for, or how is that?
That is a good summary. Yeah, I would agree.
What do brands do if they have too little data?
I'll try to get more. I mean, in the end, there are two tactics or two strategies. You could say I try to make the maximum out of my little data, or I try to generate more data.
Yeah.
And if you choose the second way, there are a lot of ways to do or to generate more data in all categories, like in zero, first, and third party data categories.
Yeah. Ask more, basically.
Yeah, you can ask more.
Yeah.
It's the example I told you before with the birthday gift. Yeah. I mean, you can ask the customer, please give me your birthday. Yeah. I want to send you a birthday card or present. But in general, it's like, especially on your digital channels, or if you're running a loyalty program as well, of course, it's important that you try to encourage your customers to register and to give a consent for usage of data, for communication, because registering is one point, but you also need to have the consent that you can use this data, and you need to have the consent that you can talk to the customer, because otherwise it's hard to reach the customer, especially when you think in outbound measures, not in inbound measures, like your website, for example. This can be like registration for an email list. It can be a creation of a customer account or registration for a loyalty program, for example. And especially maybe this is a good example, when you, for example, running a loyalty program. In Switzerland, there are two big loyalty programs, like compared to Payback in Germany, it's like Coop and Super and Migro. These are the both big retail chains in Switzerland, and they have both a loyalty program, which is both are 25 years old. So they started really early. And both have a distribution or a household distribution of over 80% in Switzerland. So really huge. And they are far beyond 1.5 million registered households, even in small Switzerland. But what did they do? They both asked persistently their customers at the cashier zone.
Yeah.
Or the cashiers asked them, do you have a loyalty card? Yeah. Oh, you don't have one. Oh, then you missed this.
Yeah. Simply so asking that, people on a consistent basis. Yeah. That works.
Yeah. And then it was like kind of really persistent and some people get annoyed, but in the end, it was, in my opinion, it was a huge success factor. Why? Of course, they're big retail chains, so they have many stores. So this is another factor as well. But constantly asking your customers is really driving a membership. So your membership base is growing.
Yeah. And I guess also just having the loyalty program with the loyalty card and giving a bit of points in return, that will create more transaction data that you can actually tie up to an end customer individual instead of just having the anonymous purchases.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So you have first party data then as well, and you can use this for marketing automation, personalization, and so on.
And I've seen a lot of maybe especially FMCG or CPG companies that they are they're struggling with this because they don't have the transaction, because that's normally happening with the retailers and the resellers.
That's why retail media is becoming quite successful.
So retail media is for, I mean, that's what they can do, because the resellers know their customers better than they do themselves.
Mm.
It's one way, but also maybe not for groceries, but for, I've seen that for more mechanical products like sewing machines and so on, having people register. That still works for extended warranty or whatever. If it's a product that people care about, then the CPG companies can actually make that work.
Yeah, that's definitely a good use case. We have a few companies where you're working together on things like this, like getting the people registered, so like getting the consent, getting the communication opt-in, and then try to create customer engagement with them.
Yeah.
And it's not all. It doesn't necessarily always have to be about like hard selling. Mm. I mean, that's with retail, it's the first thing that comes into mind is like another discount.
Yeah.
But you also have to think about like what kind of additional services I can provide, for example. Or sometimes it's just about like engaging with the customer in a creative way. It doesn't necessarily have to be like there is another discount.
Yeah.
This is the easiest thing.
Yeah, I spoke with a senior executive from actually a sewing machine company. I think it was at one of your events in Cologne. And I was a bit surprised, because they're selling through resellers. I was a bit surprised with how much first-party data they actually have, because people love these sewing machines and everybody's registering them, and they're even keeping them as collector's items. And all the patterns and the recipes, like the sewing recipes, is really a treasured asset. So getting people to register in order to get these recipes back is easier than you'd probably imagine. So even though they were reselling or selling through resellers, they had a lot of first-party data. So it's that's also a thing you can consider. I mean, either have assets that you can give away to get data in return that is maybe just content or recipes in this case, or building it into your product. So the product goes online and that will enable you to collect data. I've seen that worked as well.
Yes, we're
drawing towards an end here, Michael.
No, time's running.
Thanks for all that. So there's one question that I always ask the people on this podcast, and that's for their own favorite example of personalization that they've experienced as a consumer. And I'm going to ask you, what's the favorite example that you have of personalization where you've been personalized to? You've been at the receiving end of personalization. What is that?
Well, it's not surprisingly, and maybe also quite boring. The first example would be Spotify, because we talked about it before. It's they got me. They locked me into the system, and their customer experience, or the customer experience I have with them, it's just great. So there is no need for me to change. So this is, but of course, this is one of the really big players. So not all companies are that big and don't have that much resources and money and so on. Another is Netflix, the same, but it's for me almost the same. It's not that good, but Netflix always has, I would say, at least one recommendation for us, which fits our taste. And that's why also they generate a lock-in to us. So we have others, like we have Sky and so on, but it's like 80% is Netflix.
Yeah.
And then, but maybe these are like the big ones. Yeah. I think most of people mention, or a lot of people mention this. But
clearly companies who have personalization at a very core piece, part of their strategy. So it's not it's not an operational thing that they're sort of doing a bit with on top. That's sort of the core of their business.
That's right. Yeah. That's why maybe I have to mention another example. Maybe you know About You. This is an online fashion store in or a marketplace in Germany. And what they do quite good is they combine data, technology, and also creativity.
Mm.
And although many of their like automations, for example, are really classics, basics, like a shopping basket reminder, watch list reminders, or really the basic stuff often.
Yeah.
But they did it in a, how do you say, in a charming way, in a creative way. It's not like you forgot something in your shopping basket. So they really do it a creative way. And why I think this is quite a good example, and why I like it is because they do it differently on one hand. And what this also shows in it's now it's more not from the customer perspective, it's more like from the professional perspective. It's that personalization is not only about like mastering your data and mastering your technology. It's also about mastering your marketing.
Yeah.
So you have to bring all this together. And this is what fascinates me in personalization, because it's not technology, it's not data, yeah. It's so much more.
Yeah.
And you have to bring all these skills together. And this makes it really, really an interesting area.
Yeah.
But also quite a challenging one,
yeah.
Because it's not just like, yeah, a straightforward thing. You have to do this and then this is the outcome. It's a journey, like a customer journey. It's like a journey for every company, and quite a challenging journey, but a very, very interesting one.
Really. Yeah. And I like that point, you know, personalization not being only about the data, because there's a lot of stuff to be done with data. But if you forget about the content and the creativity and the fun and what makes it engaging and interesting, then you're missing half of the equation, which is also one of the reasons that in the bow tie of personalization, the main model from Hello First Name, there are two sides of the bow tie. There's the insight part and there's the content part. And if you fail to provide either of them, you're really losing out and you're not doing successful personalization. All right. We're at the end here. Michael, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's been a huge pleasure, really. And for the audience, I'll just say thank you for listening in on this. And do join us next week. Please subscribe. Next week will be an audiobook chapter. And remember that all the models and even a written abstract can be downloaded totally for free. And I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes. So thank you for staying with us this podcast episode.
Thank you for listening in on this episode of Hello First Name. Remember that all models and even a written abstract of the book are available for download. You'll find the link in the show notes.
In our next episode, which is a classical audiobook chapter, we'll be listening to Chapter 17, Conversion Rate Optimization and Personalization. How do the two disciplines relate? And when are you done optimizing the generic customer experience for the average customer and should move into optimizing the specific customer experience for the known user?